Thank you. So I guess some changes since I submitted my abstract. I'm now actually in the Department of Medicine at Stanford University with the Stanford Prevention Research Center. No worries. So thank you. So I'll be presenting today looking at current smoking among the job-seeking unemployed in California. And this also is a community-based participatory research award that funded the initial study and its ongoing work. We just started the grant in August. But my collaborators, Amy Rogers and Stephen Ramblin, who are with Buckaloo Programs in Marin County, and it's an employment service agency specifically for individuals with behavioral health disorders, so psychiatric or addictive disorders. And then Yanling Shi, who's at the University of California, San Francisco, who ran the analyses for us. And I want to acknowledge that I do, this is the grant funding for the that I mentioned for this study. And we analyzed data here from the California Health Interview Survey. So these are publicly available data that we analyzed, and I want to recognize all the hard work that goes into doing this survey for the data collection. From my disclosure, I do have funding for investigator-initiated research award from Pfizer and have been an ad hoc member on their advisory board, and I did grant review for them recently this year. So why would we be interested in this issue of employment and tobacco use? Tobacco use increases healthcare costs for work sites. It's associated with greater unproductive time, so more breaks, as well as absenteeism. So employers are increasingly becoming concerned about tobacco use among their employees. Actions have been taken to reduce smoking in the workforce, and these can range on kind of a continuum. More and more, they're seeing testing for nicotine or cotinine, which is a metabolite of nicotine that stays in the body for about 72 hours, among those who apply for jobs. And they can either be perhaps refused for a job if they have positive for nicotine or cotinine, or can be told that they can reapply in 6 months. There's some different ways in which this is being done. Work sites are adopting zero evidence policies. What that means is that the employees cannot smell of tobacco, they cannot have any evidence of recent use of tobacco, and that's zero evidence policies. Also, steps saying that you cannot smoke at all during the workday, so whether, you know, the eight-hour workday or however long the shifts are, that the individual cannot smoke at all. They cannot leave the site to go smoke in their car, that kind of thing. On a kind of a more positive way, work sites are offering financial incentives. If people quit smoking, they can get reduced costs for their health care, or they can get payment for quitting smoking. Or the reverse, if they don't quit smoking, they may have to pay more for their medical insurance. So I heard some wows. It sounds like this isn't that well known. There have been a number of headlines that have come out, and we have a Google Plus page where we're highlighting as more and more news comes out in this area. The Mayo did a study that showed that workplace smoking bans have powerful health effects. So if work sites ban smoking, it has good health outcomes for their employees. Another one from Spain, smoking falls following workplace ban in Spain. California Assembly votes to outlaw smoking on hospital campuses, and we are seeing this more and more in healthcare settings as well as in universities. Workplaces ban not only smoking, but smokers themselves. This is from USA Today. Employers ban smoking in personal lives, job applicants testing positive for nicotine not hired. Smokers need not apply in Doylestown Township, which is in Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia. Humana won't hire smokers in Arizona. If you light up a cigarette, it'll sniff out your chances to land a job with this health insurance agent. Giant, rather. Geisinger will stop hiring smokers also from Pennsylvania, more in the coal region. Toledo casinos even now not hiring smokers. And then this one, Steve Spurrier staff, that sloppy bachelor smokers need not apply. So I'm seeing this hit some different industries, even athletics. So is this legal? This often comes up when people hear about this new project that we're working on. Well, can employers really do this? So there's been a number of different kind of cases testing it out. 1987 Federal Appeals Court ruling determined that smokers were not a protected class. And non-nicotine hiring policies are legal in 20 states. And the California Labor Code, which is where we're doing the study, does not prevent an employer from firing or disciplining employees who smell of tobacco smoke at work. And then employees who have claimed nicotine addiction under the Americans with Disabilities Act have not been successful. So courts have refused to define addiction to smoking as a disability. And then while we're doing this research now, it's timely. So, you know, clearly we've been in a recession. Unemployment rates are very high. These are data from August. Nationally, unemployment rate 8%, 10.6% in California. This shows the curve over time. There's the recession in the shaded part and then the high levels of unemployment. So employers can be more selective in their decision-making when hiring an individual. So they may decide, okay, well, I've got these two applicants, and I can see that one's a smoker. Maybe I'm not going to go with them. And individuals who smoke may be at a serious economic disadvantage. And what do we know about tobacco use? Well, it's more prevalent among certain minority groups, among low income, among those with less education. And so it's more likely that certain groups are going to be harder hit by these activities. What's been done before? There's been a number of studies showing that smoking is associated with being unemployed. It's been shown in Italy, Scotland, Sweden, and the U.S. The prior research has focused on select industries. So, for example, like construction workers was one study. The data that were collected were some time ago, so about 3 to 4 decades ago. And there's been limited consideration of relevant covariates. So you definitely want to control for things like education. We also control for like binge drinking, which is related to tobacco use. We also look at overweight status. And then the studies have summarize their odds ratios in the range of 1.51 to 2.23, so about a 50% or twofold increase in the likelihood of being unemployed if somebody's a smoker, or the likelihood of smoking if you're unemployed. So the purpose of our study was to examine the association between cigarette smoking and employment status among adults in California, and this is a state with strong anti-tobacco sentiment. So we wanted to see, you know, particularly in a state that has a lot of controls against secondhand smoke exposure and against tobacco, what is the relationship between tobacco use and employability here? And we control for relevant covariates of education, gender, age, ethnicity, marital status, overweight status, and binge drinking. These data are cross-sectional, so that is a limitation of what we're looking at here. We combined data from 2 years, 2007-2009, again from the California Health Interview Survey. This is a telephone-based survey. It does reach out to cell phones as well as landlines. It doesn't make concerted effort for participation. Try to be representative, but of course you're not going to get individuals who may be homeless or not have a phone. So there are, again, some limitations to the data. The data that we analyzed was nearly 70,000 non-institutionalized adults aged 20 to 65. And we limited it 20 to 65 because we wanted them to be in the, in the working years and not be concerned about people who are perhaps in college or might be heading towards retirement. We classified individuals as never smokers, so they'd never smoked at least 100 cigarettes in their lifetime, current smokers, at least 100 cigarettes in their lifetime and saying that they're currently smoking, or former smokers, 100 or more cigarettes in their lifetime and not smoking now. Employment status, we categorize three groups, which is how the CHIST, the California Health Interview Survey, does this. Unemployed job seeking, that's the group that we were interested in. Among individuals who are actively looking for work, what's their rate to tobacco use, and how is tobacco use being related to looking for work? We compared these individuals to employed individuals, either part or full-time, as well as to unemployed, non-job seeking individuals, which is a mouthful, but it incorporated a kind of a mixed group of individuals who might be students in college, may be retired, they may be disabled, they may be homemakers, but we saw them as different from unemployed job-seeking. Demographics, binge drinking, we used the traditional definitions, 5 or more drinks among men, 4 or more drinks among women in a single episode, and this was in the past year. And then obesity status, the BMI, body mass index of at least 30. Analyses were done in SAS. Some of the kind of analyses that we ran. We did use the sample weights that are provided for CHIST so that it's a representative state representative sample. And we were looking to test association between tobacco use and employment in univariate and multivariate models. Okay, so what did we see? We saw the job-seeking unemployed smokers were most likely to be current smokers, so the rate of current smoking was about 21% among those who were unemployed job-seeking compared to about 15.5% among those unemployed not job-seeking, and those were not significantly different from the employed. And then we also saw that those who were job-seeking unemployed were least likely to be former smokers, so more likely to smoke now and less likely to have quit smoking relative to the other two groups. We looked at the correlates, you know, why we're having these in the models, because we did see that smoking prevalence, in addition to being highest among the unemployed job-seeking, also highest among men, older people, unmarried, people who are identified as binge drinkers, had lower education, who are underweight, as well as non-Hispanic blacks and other race ethnicity relative to Caucasians. And then we looked at the percent who are unemployed. Current smokers had the highest prevalence of job-seeking unemployment. So nearly 9% of those were job-seeking unemployed, which, you know, whereas those only 5% among former smokers and about 5% among never smokers. And then no difference in being non-job-seeking unemployed there. We looked at this in multivariate logistic regression analyses to control for the covariates. And again, still current smoking was significant. The adjusted odds ratio, 1.23, which says you've got a 23% increased likelihood of being unemployed and job seeking if you're a current smoker. Former smoking status was not related to being unemployed and job seeking. And then we saw that if you're a female, more likely to be unemployed, job seeking. If you had less than a high school degree, more likely to be unemployed, job seeking. Whereas less than if you had a college degree, less likely to be unemployed, job seeking if you're older, and then more likely if you're another race, identified as another ethnicity or racial category. How about for unemployed non-job seeking? In fact, once you control for the covariates, both current smoking status and former smoking status are predictive of being unemployed and non-job seeking. And then a number of covariates, being female, less than high school degree, being older, being underweight, and having being identified as other race, were more likely to be unemployed, non-job seeking. Whereas if you had more education, if you were overweight, and if you were a binge drinker, you were less likely to be unemployed, non-job seeking. So what do we see again? Tobacco use is pretty simple. Tobacco use greatest among the job-seeking unemployed. And this is relative to employed and non-job-seeking unemployed. We controlled for relevant covariates, and this still was significant. So why do we care about this? We see smoking is relevant to employment. And this is the work that we're doing now in the study that we're funded to do, is where we're working with employment service agencies to start raising the issue of tobacco use and looking them at as a setting to treat tobacco dependence, because we see it as an opportunity. Here's an agency that's working with individuals who are at high risk of using tobacco. And here's a time in their life when they're economically hurting, okay, so why give their money to the tobacco industry? And they may be motivated to quit if they hear, hey, tobacco is related to being unemployed. If you quit smoking, maybe this will help you get employed. And that's the work that we're doing now. And yet, from what we've seen in the literature, tobacco treatment trials have not looked at this setting as an area to intervene upon tobacco use. Limitations, cross-sectional design. You know, I can't tell you that tobacco use caused unemployment or that unemployment caused tobacco use. So that is actually what we're proposing to do, what we've been funded to do, is to follow 100 smokers, 100 non-smokers, over time and see about what how soon do people get employed and what industries do they get employed in and how is it related to other factors in demographic characteristics and other factors in their life. These are California data. This is a state with strong tobacco control legislation. This is during an economic downturn, so it may not generalize to all states. However, there is an interesting study that came out recently that looked at CDC data from 2004 to 2008, again, cross-sectional data, but 11 different states, and they found a modest association between workplace discrimination and current smoking. And it's held across diverse racial and ethnic groups, and it's unclear, again, did tobacco use cause discrimination in the workplace, or did workplace discrimination cause tobacco use? So again, we need longitudinal studies. Future research. I really see tobacco use, employability, and worksite climate at this intersection of employment law, public health, and economics. So a lot of really interesting disciplines coming together that warrants further investigation and at a national level. We need prospective trials to evaluate whether tobacco use is indeed harmful to employability and to look at feasibility, acceptability, and efficacy of actually delivering tobacco treatment within employment service agencies. So that's my presentation. I will answer questions, and then if anybody's seeking employment, I will mention that I just joined, as I mentioned, Stanford in July. It's an amazing place to be, and we actually have two to three positions available right now, assistant and associate level, in the Department of Medicine for individuals who are focused on prevention research. Probably doesn't help you if you smoke, but probably wouldn't be if you do. And then we also have a T32 fellowship program funded by a National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, which we've had since 1975. And there's a link there if people are interested. And that application deadline is November 15th. And by all means, if you have any questions about either of these programs, feel free to connect with me after this.
Rare luxury of AKJ about questions from the floor to one or all of the speakers?
I came in the middle of this talk. Is your sample a California sample specifically? Okay, so California has a much lower smoking prevalence than many other states. To what degree do you think that sort of the more health conscious and other efforts that have been done in California changing that population a little bit relates, you know, for example, to the degree to which you apply to a state like mine, where the prevalence rates are much higher?
Great question. California has been amazing in terms of leading the way in curbing tobacco prevalence across the state. And we've got the second lowest tobacco prevalence in the U.S. That said, there's certainly populations that have not been well impacted. So while our smoking rate is below 15%, I think it's about 13% now, there was a recent study done at the county hospital in the city, and the smoking rate in San Francisco is about 12%. And there was work done by Dr. Neil Benowitz, who's at UCSF, where he looked at cotinine levels among admissions to the hospital. So it's a county hospital, uninsured, you know, low income, ethnically diverse, and the smoking prevalence was 40%. Yeah. And when you go into the psychiatric unit, it was 60%. And then with Buckaloo programs that we're working at, they've been tracking tobacco use, and they estimated at 50%. So again, I think for certain populations, it's just not been well served by the efforts to address tobacco use. So certain industries, I'm anticipating that in certain service industries and more construction labor industries, tobacco use may be more accepted than what we might find in other industries. But as far as how it would impact the differences, like California has a more stringent or more flexible perhaps in allowing work sites to have restrictions on tobacco use. Right. If you go to another state that doesn't have those policies, then certainly I think you're less likely to find an association with employment.
Right. I'll just share with you that, for instance, in a paper we're working on right now, where we are looking at some psychosocial characteristics in the community, genetic sense, I think that study, that age has no bearing on most heavy smokers, the smoking prevalence, et cetera. Huh. And that drinking in the Deep South is any outcome. So I think their population base may vary in terms of the relationships based on you know, social niche. And like that.
Interesting. Great. Thank you.
Yeah.
For sharing that.
Well, the training, we did not put that in there, and we should have, in hindsight. What we did do, however, was talk with folks at the EPA as to how a family could sort of smoke-proof their home, you know, like putting wet towel at the bottom of the door. But, I mean, just certain little things like that. And how to clean the walls with a sugar cleaning formula that they can make to get the third-hand smoke particles off the walls if their landlord didn't repaint or clean. And the reason why we really didn't put anything about advocating is because we tried really hard at the beginning to figure out how to get them to we did advocating on banning smoking in cars in Minnesota, and we brought in a lot of advocates and community groups, and the parents just didn't seem to think that that was something that they wanted to do. So instead of putting it in the manual as something that may not necessarily have relevance to them, we decided to take it out. But in hindsight, we might put it back in. But you make a good query. That's an excellent question.
Any other questions?
question for Dr. Stewart, which asks, in your study, did you explore the possible variable of mental illness, thinking specifically of depression, bipolar disorder, or schizophrenia, as elements that might be correlated with both smoking, basically for self-medication, and unemployability or health literacy?
That's a really great question, actually. And in this particular study, we assessed depression with the CESD, but did not use any other measures to look at more severe mental illness. And that's actually one of the things that I'm looking at right now, is relations between depression and health literacy and smoking outcomes. So one of the things that we found, just in a study that I'm actually working on writing up the paper, is that people who had higher levels of depression just based on the CST, and this is also an example of smokers, that was related to lower health literacy. And we found that social support actually did mediate that relationship between lower health literacy and higher levels of depression. So, I think that's a really good thing to look at, and hopefully in future studies that's something that we can do.
No, it's a fantastic question, a really important area and concern. With the CHIST, the California Health Interview Survey, they didn't do diagnostic measures, so we wouldn't know if somebody has bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or depression. They do have the Kessler, and so that is something we could look at. We're going more with behavioral issues like the binge drinking and the obesity as kind of other factors that employers may be more, concerned about, but certainly we could look at mental distress as well. Good question. Yeah, so we very much want to use it as a motivational time, motivational key for moving people towards the idea of quitting smoking. So, yes, looking for work is incredibly stressful, and yet it's very costly to smoke, and here you're feeling like you're under the control of the tobacco industry, and how can you gain more feelings of self-control, and viewing yourself as an individual who's independent, and making changes in their life, and that kind of thing. So we really very much are looking to use it as a turning point in their life and reaching them through employment service agencies, because they're coming there often anyways, or they can be reached electronically through the internet, by phone. So really a way to initially establish contact at a time where they are concerned about finances, are looking at their life and who they are and how they define themselves, and again using that motivationally. And yet we're also kind of walking in this tight line because we're working with employers, and some do not know that you can discriminate against smokers and make hiring decisions. So we're also looking at the extent to which do employers know that this is something that they could do. How much are they doing this implicitly versus explicitly already? And then again, using that information to encourage smokers, say, look, you don't want to be at a disadvantage walking in because you smell of smoke, because you've got a pack of cigarettes in your pocket.
Well, as far as the centers are concerned, once we disseminated the findings through the 11 Hennepin County Strong Beginnings Centers, it became clear to them that this was an issue for their staff. And because many of the staff smoked, we're talking about an inner city, lower income population. And additionally, it's hard to find good help, right? So many of them had to go with what they could get, trained at a lower level AA. So measures they're taking are the use of a smoking jacket. I'm not exactly sure how much that will help, but if they go out to smoke, they have to put this jacket on, and when they come back in, the jacket has to stay outside. At this point, they are not utilizing it as, or smoking tobacco as a means not to hire. But again, I didn't even know that you could make hiring decisions based on whether or not somebody, this is new to me, you know. So this is information I will share back with them, but they're not really thinking about not hiring. They're just thinking about how to, in the moment, how to deal with it in the moment, and then future ways to deal with it.
Can I ask one around that? Because I did see that the smoking jackets, and what kind of reflections did you get from the staff that you heard? Here you were bringing this intervention for parents, and did you have aha moments with the staff, or say, I don't hear?
The most interesting thing that I found out was that the directors really didn't want you to interact with the staff, which is odd. So whatever information I gave to them, they would then want to disseminate in whatever way they decided to talk about it or to make it a practice. So I don't know, it was very odd. I really don't even have a question because, I mean, an answer to that, because they were not really looking at it as a serious issue at that moment in time to do anything about it. And the smoking jackets didn't really do anything. I mean, you know that. And anybody who in here does smoking research knows that. So I don't know.
Well, then I just would like to say thank you to all the panelists for a great session, and we just want to